Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope your day's off to a good start. Coming up later this hour, ice cream and sex work. What's a hot day, right? We'll hear listeners' picks for the best local ice cream, and we'll debate a New York bill that would decriminalize prostitution. First, NBC announced this morning its panel of moderators for the kickoff Democratic candidate debate. We're just over 2 weeks away. Lester Holt, Savannah Guthrie, Chuck Todd, Rachel Maddow will team with Telemundo's Jose Diaz-Balart. Holt is the constant. The others will get an hour each paired with Holt. The Democratic National Committee's in the process of determining which group of 10 will be on the Wednesday night, the other group of 10 that will be on the Thursday night. With us to talk about the process of putting together these very important first few debates from Morning Score newsletter at Politico, campaign reporter Zach Montalero. Zach, good to have you with us today. First, can you elaborate a little bit more on the format for the two nights?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Larry. So the formatting for the two nights is it'll be two debates, June 26th, June 27th, down in Miami, and there'll be 10 candidates on both nights, 10 on the first night, 10 on the second night. And those candidates will basically be randomly assigned. So there's no lower tier of candidates going on one night with all the high polling candidates going the other night. Instead, it'll be the top candidates spread across both nights and the lower bottom tier candidates spread across both nights as well.
Okay, so no kiddie table kind of thing as we had. I don't remember if that was the last Democratic, I'm sorry, last Republican series, but I know there was a lot of complaint about sort of having the higher polling candidates and then the lower ones having to do an off prime time broadcast.
Yeah, that was in 2016. That was the Republicans when, if you remember, they broke out the lower tier candidates into a kiddie table debate, an undercard debate, whatever you want to call it. That at one point was literally filmed in an empty arena, which, you know, made a lot of people very unhappy when the regular debate had a crowd, had an audience. So instead, the Democrats this cycle have been very public. They publicly acknowledge they don't want to do that. DNC chief Tom Perez, who is in charge of setting these requirements, has said, you know, we want to give every candidate a fair shot. So instead of doing that undercard debate, they're going to be randomly assigning candidates. And that random assignment will come on Friday.
So you could potentially have one debate that has the ones with greater name recognition, the others the lesser known, or it could be mixed up all depending on the random draw. I wonder also about the rules for the debate. Is that negotiated between the Democratic National Committee and NBC, say, for the first one, as to what ground is covered, the types of questions? Or, to your knowledge, does NBC have full journalistic latitude?
Sure. So, actually, they're splitting up the higher-tier candidates into randomly as well, too. So they're guaranteeing that of the candidates polling above 2%, of which there's 9 of them, 4 will be one night, 5 will be the other night. So it's, you know, to avoid weighing one or the other. And these rules, at least, largely came from the DNC. They probably consulted with their media partners. NBC is hosting the first debate. CNN, which is hosting the second debate in July, these are the same rules across those nights, largely set by the DNC. But the randomness is kind of from the DNC to ensure that there is no to ensure that there's no undercard debate, basically.
And in the subject areas, NBC has full latitude to ask in whatever area they want?
Yes. Yeah. NBC, when it actually comes to asking the questions, that's up to NBC.
And Rachel Maddow included, it's less typical, I think, to include someone who does an opinion-oriented primetime cable news show who's an advocate. I think she has done one other one. There have been maybe a couple of others, but that's less common, I know, than having people who are, more straightforward news people. Do you know if there was any discussion about using Maddow with the DNC, given that there might be a feeling she's more positive towards some of the Democratic candidates than others?
I'm not sure of a conversation that the network of the DNC had either way, But, you know, Rachel Maddow's show has been a must stop basically for every Democratic presidential candidate. And Rachel Maddow, you know, had filled a similar role in 2016 for the primary debates. You know, it would be incredibly unusual to expect to see Rachel Maddow in a general election debate. But for a primary debate for the Democratic Party, it kind of makes sense. It kind of, for the Democrats, Rachel Maddow is the leading voice on television. So having her up there asking questions can at least bring eyeballs to this debate, certainly.
And I'd love to hear from our listeners. As you look at the history of presidential candidates' debates, which one really stood out for you? Was there a debate going back in previous election cycles where there was a candidate maybe you knew next to nothing about, and that candidate really popped out in the way that she or he answered a question? Maybe it was an injection of humor. Maybe the way that they shared something that was more heartfelt than others were, giving more stock answers in the debate. It's a chance for you to share any moment that really stood out for you historically, looking back at presidential candidate debates. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Also the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Zach, of the 20 candidates that have qualified, that leaves a few that were not that didn't reach the threshold. Who were the people left out of these first two debates?
Sure. So we actually still have candidates have through Wednesday to qualify, and there's actually a poll coming out within the next 45 minutes that could totally blow this all up. It could totally a 21st candidate. So we could theoretically, you know, go with this. Only 20 candidates could be on stage, so it's not locked in yet. But the four that right now, if we cut it off right at this very moment, the four that would not make it are Montana Governor Steve Bullock, Massachusetts Representative Seth Moulton, Florida Mayor Wayne Nessem, and former Senator Mike Gravel. Those are the four that at this current moment wouldn't make it. Of those four, the only one with really any plausible shot of qualifying in the next, you know, 36 hours, give or take, would be Governor Bullock. Governor Bullock is a single poll away from qualifying. We know of two polls coming out in the next 24 hours or so, one within the next hour and one probably sometime tomorrow afternoon, that he could theoretically qualify off. If he gets 1% in one of those two polls, he would qualify off a complicated bunch of tiebreakers, basically.
So does that knock someone else out since they've said there'll only be 20?
It could. So it's I have no idea what these polls are going to say yet. So basically what it could do is it could knock out one of those other candidates who's just at 1% in three polls, basically the bare minimum to get on stage. If Governor Bullock crosses that threshold, you know, we could either see a perfect tie between multiple candidates with 1% in three polls, or if Governor Bullock gets more than 1% in the next two polls, that would totally eliminate somebody. You know, the clearer case would be if Governor Bullock gets above 1% in these polls. You know, that's a pretty clear-cut case. That means someone else is below him. It's what happens if this happens, if Governor Bullock gets exactly 1% and he's perfectly tied. The person currently filling the 20th spot, if you were to rank it, is California Representative Eric Swalwell. So what happens if Eric Swalwell and Governor Bullock are perfectly tied? We're not sure, actually.
Yeah, well, they do. Yeah. All right. Let's go back and hear a couple of performances in debates. We go back to 1984, President Reagan running for re-election, being challenged by former Vice President Walter Mondale. And Reagan was asked by the moderator about his age.
You already are the oldest president in history, and some of your staff say you were tired after your most recent encounter with Mr. Mondale. I recall yet that President Kennedy had to go for days on end with very little sleep during the Cuba Missile Crisis. Is there any doubt in your mind that you would be able to function in such circumstances?
Not at all, Mr. Truitt, and I want you to know that also I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit for political purposes my opponent's youth and inexperience.
This is one of those golden answers in a debate that gets much quoted, replayed the next morning, which, of course, is ideally what a candidate wants. Much tougher to do with 10 people on stage than just two candidates. With us, Mitchell McKinney, professor of communication, director of the Political Communications Institute at the University of Missouri. Professor McKinney, welcome.
Larry, good to be with you.
So that's an example of a candidate, obviously, you know, knocking it out of the park on an area where there's some question about, you know, is the candidate have a weakness here going to make it difficult for him? What are some of the other highlights that you can point to where candidates were able to rise above a stock answer and really make an impact?
Well, you know, as I listened to that clip that you played and hearing the news cycle the past couple of days, I'm wondering if Joe Biden will have to come prepared with, as Ronald Reagan did, because age had become an issue leading into that debate with Walter Mondale. And it was very clear that Reagan was quite prepared to, as the journalist, Mr. Truitt, said, to knock it out of the ballpark when that question came to him. And those are, as you say, the moments that we remember from debates. Now, in the primary debate, I'm thinking back, certainly candidates can rise to the moment. Actually, one of the more devastating moments in a recent primary debate, I believe it was in the 2012 cycle with Rick Perry, who was rising, who was seen as sort of a rising star in the Republican Party when he was asked, he had been touting that he would close certain federal agencies, and when he was asked that question, he couldn't remember them, and that was his oops moment in that 2012 debate. Historically, in terms of other moments, we could go all the way back to 1984 in a Democratic primary debate. This was where Walter Mondale had gotten somewhat tired of hearing Gary Hart talk about his new ideas, his new plans. And so using one of the commercials of the day, he finally said to Mondale, "Where's the beef?" in terms of his new idea. So certainly those types of moments in a debate can, I think, aid someone in terms of their image, or it also can be devastating for a candidate.
Yvonne in Tustin writes on our AirTalk page, Obama, in terms of someone she wasn't familiar with who made an impression in a debate. Yvonne says, I had no idea who he was until I heard him speak at one of the debates. What an orator, I must say. That's Yvonne in Tustin. Joaquin in South Los Angeles says, my favorite debate moment, Bush versus Gore. Circular debate stage, both candidates seated. Bush gets up to answer a question posed by Gore. Gore stands up, moves to stand right next to Bush while he finishes his answer. It was a great lesson in body language. Bush exuding confidence that his brother never had in 2016. Enzo in Newport Beach, what moment for you really stood out in the many candidates' debates over the years?
Hello. Yes, I was recalling the debate, the last presidential debate, when Chris Christie called out Marco Rubio for repeating a political talking point rather than actually debating. And then Marco Rubio repeated the same talking point again,
yes.
Unable to answer back to Christie.
That was a really powerful moment, Enzo, because like he fell right into that. Mitchell McKinney, your thoughts about that moment, which seemed devastating for Rubio.
You know, that's where our research finds that people trust debates in terms of a source of communication. And when we tease that out and we say, now, what is it about the debate as in terms of a useful source of information? What is generally seen is that these debates are among the least scripted. The candidates, they don't know the questions that are going to be put to them. They certainly don't know what one of their opponents is going to say to them that they will have to reply to. And what we're seeing really is, how do they handle themselves under pressure? And that moment that we were just discussing in terms of Rubio, it becomes clear to the viewers then, okay, this person has some substance. This person is not just reciting some talking point over and over. And we generally think that we see the real candidate, the authentic candidate, if you will, on the debate stage and how they handle themselves under pressure. And I think that's why the viewership of these debates, general election and primary debates, the last cycle 4 years ago had some of the highest viewership in terms of the history of primary debates. And they and these debates tend to be seen as very useful for voters getting to know these candidates, many of whom that they really haven't seen on a national stage.
Yeah, I think all three of these pairs of debates are going to get huge audiences because people do want to learn more about the candidates, even in this rather limited format where each only gets a few minutes. Ralph writes on the page, in the Democratic Party's primary debates leading up to the 92 presidential election, Jerry Brown, Paul Tsongas were there valid candidates, each with good policy ideas. I was especially impressed by Jerry Brown's command of detail. But Bill Clinton waited for the others to finish speaking and then sent something along the lines of, I think what we all have in common here is making himself sound presidential, Ralph says. It always stuck in my mind is the moment Bill Clinton moved away from the pack, for better or worse. That's Ralph writing on the Air Talk page. That's a really interesting observation, Mitch, because it was kind of about how he framed it as opposed to the specifics of what he said.
Exactly. And I think the dynamic picked up on there is really something that we watch for in these primary debates. Again, these are intra-party. Unlike the general election, these the 10 on the stage are all from the same party. How do they promote this cohesiveness, this party unity? Do they? Or and we see the fluctuations in the polls. We see the contenders that are sort of in the second round, and perhaps will they go after that front runner? And how do they do that? How do they make the distinctions between themselves, their ideas, and their fellow party candidates? And that's a very tricky thing on the primary debate stage. We typically see some sense of or some desire to try to hold party unity, and then every once in a while that breaks down. Certainly on the Republican side 4 years ago, that's what I think made those debates. Again, the viewership was so high. In many ways, there was no sense from the get-go, the very first one, Donald Trump taking on the other Republicans on the stage and the name-calling in somewhat vicious manner. It'll be interesting to see how the Democrats take that on, where certainly some of those candidates on the stage later this month will be attempting to make distinctions between their ideas, their record, and fellow Democrats, and then how do they do that?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. Well, we have many opportunities in the next couple of weeks to look at some of the ways, particularly the lesser known candidates, will try and distinguish themselves from the large field taking part in the debates. Professor McKinney, good to talk with you. Can we check in with you again on these debates? You got a lot of good information we didn't even have a chance to get to.
Listen, I hope we will. Very good being with you.
I appreciate it. Mitchell McKinney is University of Missouri Professor of Communication, and he directs the Political Communications Institute at Missouri. And our thanks to Politico's Zach Montalero, who is the author of the Morning Score newsletter. He covers campaigns. It's Air Talk on KPCC. In just a minute, we'll hear from you. Your favorite ice cream in Southern California. Where's your favorite place to go? And do you have a favorite flavor at that location? 866-893-KPCC. It's so hot, we got to talk ice cream coming up next.